Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Over the years, I have been tremendously impressed by and learned much from the native intelligence of our first guest. His name is Ambassador Yoram Ettinger. He has served his country, Israel, with great distinction, among other places, here in its embassy in Washington, where he was responsible for congressional relations for quite some time. Also as the director of the consulate in Houston, Texas, which accounts for his very enthusiastic embrace of the culture of Texas, including cowboy boots, and I believe a cowboy hat on occasion. It's always great to see him in that regalia. It's always great to have him on our program as well, especially at a moment when there is a lot going on in the Middle East, much of it very troubling, especially for those of us who are concerned not only about our own country's interests there, but also those of the Jewish state. Mr. Ambassador, it's wonderful to have you back with us, sir, on Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for taking a few minutes to join us.
Thank you. It's my privilege to be with you again.
Thank you. Let me ask you first, sir, if I can. The Biden administration, I'm persuaded, has engaged in a wrecking operation pretty much across the board since it came to office. There are a few places, I think, where that is more in evidence than with respect to the U.S. relationship with Israel. When you look back to the end of the Trump administration, the status of our ties with Israel, the state of Israeli security, for that matter, in that difficult part of the world that you all reside in, it's hard to believe how much things have been transformed in as short a time. Would you agree with that observation that whether it's with respect to Iran or the relationships with the Abraham Accord nations, whether it's our relationship more generally with friendly Gulf states, relatively friendly Gulf states, and of course what's happening in Syria and the Palestinian areas, things look a lot more bleak than they did 15 months ago. Your thoughts?
Well, in my mind, U.S.-Israel relations are primarily impacted by the global posture of the U.S. or by the posture of deterrence of the U.S., which has been eroded dramatically since January 2021. And that posture of deterrence does determine the homeland security, the national security, not only of the U.S., but of each one of its allies. Since the beginning of not only or not primarily Biden era, but the era of Secretary of State Tony Blinken, who in my mind calls the shots in the area of foreign policy and national security, since entering office, Secretary Blinken has emphasized diplomacy over military, and he has emphasized future assessment of conduct of America's enemies over past track record of America's enemies and rivals. And in that respect, he has sacrificed in many respects reality on the altar of wishful thinking, of oversimplifications. And we have seen that primarily with Iran. The attempts by the administration currently is to portray Iran as a good faith negotiator, as a regime country which is amenable to peaceful coexistence, and that clashes with the reality of the Ayatollahs of Iran, by the way, in an identical manner to the reality of 1979, January, February of 79, when the Ayatollahs took over control of Iran. And at that time, President Jimmy Carter and his team, National Security Brzezinski, Secretary of State Vance, the ambassador to Tehran, William Sullivan, they all expected Ayatollah Khomeini to enter Tehran when he came back from his exile in Paris and administer Iran in a moderate manner and to be pretty convenient for Americans. And President Jimmy Carter even told the global leaders in, it was about 10 days before the return of Ayatollah Khomeini to Tehran when he took over control of Iran, President Carter told other global leaders that he expected Ayatollah Khomeini to be preoccupied with tractors, not with tanks. The ambassador to Tehran, William Sullivan, reported to Washington that he expected Ayatollah Khomeini to behave like an Iranian Gandhi. And they all based their assessments on the very soothing verbal written messages to Washington from Ayatollah Khomeini and his assistants. They failed to study the worldview of the Ayatollahs. They failed to study the foundation of the ideology of the Ayatollahs, which have to do with very, very radical Shiite Islam aiming to bring the so-called infidel West and primarily the great Satan USA to bring them to submission, and equally speaking, to equally important, to defeat the apostate, heretic Sunni Muslims, especially Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Bahrain. And today we have a very similar management of policy, which is based much more on speculative assessment of future behavior by the Ayatollahs rather than studying their very systematic track record since 1979 until today, which clashes with the assumption that they are amenable to peaceful coexistence or being a good faith negotiator.
Mr. Messa, that seems like ancient history, even though it's a decade or two back. But at the present time, many of the same people who were responsible for the disastrous Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, including Blinken himself, I believe, have been brought back to government and seem to be desperately trying to breathe new life into either that accord or some other arrangement. Based on, again, hard experience, not wishful thinking, is there any prospect that the negotiations now underway in Geneva, in Vienna, let alone the concessions that seem to be flowing from them, will result in something better than we saw just a few years ago?
Well, it seems to me that the writing is on the wall. The U.S. administration expresses eagerness to rejoin the JCPOA, to sign an agreement with the Ayatollah's regime of Iran. And as we know from any set of negotiation, when you display eagerness, you're going to lose the confrontation or the negotiation. Moreover, we have here a great deal of wishful thinking, assuming that the Ayatollahs are going to depart from their ethos, from their vision, from their very deep attachment to a 14-year-old idea of Shiite takeover, the Persian Gulf, the Middle East, and the entire globe. The idea that they are going to depart from the most fundamental elements of their worldview, of their vision, of their policy, in return for a generous diplomatic and financial package, is anything but realism. And certainly, when at the time when you deal with a rogue regime and you make it very clear and publicly so that you are waiving the military option and you're waiving the option of regime change, you thereby provide a further tailwind to the rogue regime in Tehran. So, personally speaking, I wouldn't be shocked if there is an agreement, but that agreement is going to play into the hands, into the rogue hands of the Ayatollahs. The only way to change the policy coming out of Tehran is changing the regime ruling Tehran. And by the way, it has to start from the domestic scene. Here we have Americans and Westerners dealing with the Ayatollah's regime in Vienna on nuclear and maybe even ballistic issues, but they totally ignore the hate education inside, which is the production line of soldiers of the Islamic Revolution. How can you deal with a regime which brainwashes its people to overcome the infidel West, to submit the infidel West to Shiite Islam, and you ignore that education for the sake of a piece of paper which may or may not come out of Vienna? Sadly, the Ayatollahs are aware of that, and therefore they're interested in perpetuating that process. The longer the process of negotiation lasts, the closer they will be to nuclear capabilities and to a predominant position in the Middle East and beyond. And by the way, today they are already well entrenched in South America, in Central America, and pretty visible already very close to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Very troubling. One other place, of course, where the Iranians are very much in evidence is in Syria. And I'm interested in what seems to be a ratcheting up of the danger to Israel from that quarter and its efforts to contend with both the Iranian threat and the seeming increasing willingness of the Russians at the very moment that they're trying to get everyone focused on Ukraine. They're simultaneously, apparently, bringing intensified pressure to bear against Israel in Syria. Can you comment on what most especially the Iranians are up to there, sir, but also the Russians, who sometime align with them?
Well, absolutely. I think that so far, I don't know what will happen tomorrow, but so far, the only place where the Iranians are challenged effectively and in a military fashion is in Syria, where Israel has constrained their maneuverability to a great deal. In fact, Israel has bombed Iranian targets inside Syria, has slowed down the Iranian penetration of Syria, which is very important for Syria because that's their venue to reaching the Mediterranean. At the same time, obviously, Russia has its own interest in Syria. They've been there at least since the early 1970s. They have a well-established foothold in the port of Syria. However, at this stage, they are negotiating with Israel as well for two reasons. First of all, the Russians, as much as they encourage Iran to challenge the U.S., they are concerned about Iran's activities in Central Asia, which is in a way the soft belly, soft underbelly of Russia. And therefore, they consider the Israeli operation against Iran to a degree as supplementing Russia's own strategic interest in the region. Beyond that, the Russians are not blind to Israel's challenge of Iran through spying, cyber technologies, bombing, both in Iran itself as well as in Syria, and they respect that show of force by Israel. As much as the Russians sometimes want to agitate, they simply certainly don't want an explosion. They don't want a big bang in the Middle East, and they view a strong Israel, militarily assertive Israel, as an asset in that regard. To sum it up, there is a certain clash between Russian interest and Israeli interest, but at the same time, there is also a common denominator between the interest of Russia and Israel, and most importantly, the Russians respect force. Israel has displayed forcefully its interest in Syria, and that so far, has made it possible for Israel and Russia to minimize any conflict between them.
As they say, from your lips to God's ears, Mr. Ambassador, I hope that what we're watching is in fact going to demonstrate that modus vivendi, if you will, as opposed to things continuing to spiral into more and more dangerous directions, not least of them, of course, the fact that Israel may be condemned, I think it's not an inapt way to describe it, to having to contend with the Iranian threat of nuclear and ballistic capabilities on its own. And that's a very, very troubling prospect to someone like myself, and I think most of our audience who very strongly believes that it is in America's interest to see a secure and free and sovereign Israel able to operate in that region going forward. Lastly, Mr. Ambassador, and again, our guest is Yoram Edinger, talk a little bit, if you would, about the presence of Iranian proxies on Israel's border, armed to the teeth, specifically Hamas and Hezbollah, respectively, in Gaza and southern Lebanon.
Well, I've always professed preemption rather than reaction. I have been very concerned about Israel limiting itself to reaction to Iran's proxies bombing of Israeli target. From my perspective, it makes much more sense to preempt and hit them before they hit, they target and hit Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, as they did only a few months ago in May of 2021. But the presence of Iranian proxies on Israel's border should also be studied by the USA, because currently we have Iran and its number one proxy, Hezbollah, very, very much entrenched south of the border of the U.S., namely in Mexico, in Central America, in South America. In fact, Iran especially and Hezbollah operate training camps in South America for terrorists. Iran has introduced recently, has shared recently its own know-how and systems of building tunnels with the aim of building tunnels from Mexico to USA, just like the tunnels which Iran assisted building between Sinai and Gaza, whereby they smuggle military systems, tunnels between Gaza and Israel, where they attempt to smuggle in terrorists, and similar tunnels between Lebanon and Israel, Syria and Israel. I think it's time for the U.S. to observe that and study that phenomena in the southern and northern border of Israel in order to be better prepared and better, hopefully, preempt a repeat of such activities on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Mr. Ambassador, very important cautionary tale of what happens if you neglect these sorts of developments. Israel is not neglecting them. We certainly are. But in both cases, I'm afraid you're absolutely right. The situation is fraught, and we best be mindful of it here as well as there. I so appreciate your time, Ambassador Yoram Edinger. It's always important to talk with you, if not necessarily cheery, but it's really vital that we keep our eye on the ball, both in the Middle East and closer to home, if we are to avoid the sorts of dangers that are, I believe, very much on the rise worldwide. We look forward to our further visits with you, sir. In the meantime, I hope you'll stay well and keep up your important work at the Edinger Report. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Andrew Bremberg, the ambassador who is the president and CEO of Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, about a new document describing corporate treachery in support of the Chinese Communist Party.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A revered friend of mine has just survived the latest of myriad surgeries as part of many months of desperate attempts to save his life. To protect his privacy, let's call him Tim. Tim is one of the most brilliant national security practitioners of his generation. He's a distinguished veteran of combat overseas and the bureaucratic wars in Washington. Tim's experience mirrors what's been happening to the country he loves so deeply and has served so well. Like America, he's been racked by disease, debilitating hardships, and skyrocketing costs. Also like the USA, Tim is tenaciously fighting to survive the forces of darkness working to take him down. His heroic courage is an inspiration to those of us who love him and a hopeful sign that our nation will pull through too. Please join me in praying for Tim and for America. This is Frank Gaffney.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a delight to say we are joined by a man I admire greatly. His name is Ambassador Andrew Bremberg. He has served our country in a number of capacities of late, notably as the director of President Trump's Domestic Policy Council, in the White House. He has also been an ambassador for the United States, representing us at the United Nations and other international organizations in Geneva. But perhaps in some ways his most important mission is the one in which he is currently embarked, and that is as the president and CEO of an organization that I believe is absolutely indispensable. It is the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, and they are shortly going to be opening a superb new museum dedicated to educating, the present and future generations of the true and continuing, if not actually intensifying, threat of communism under whatever banner it flies, socialism, progressivism, radicalism of other stripes. It's fundamentally Marxist and communist in character. And I'm thrilled to have a chance to talk with him about it in the context of a really important new product of the foundation. It's called the Corporate Complicity Scorecard, which was released earlier this month. And it's my delight to be able to say I am shamelessly plugging it everywhere I go, because I think it's of vital importance that people understand what is being done by corporate and other elites, for that matter, of the United States, that enables, empowers, and emboldens our mortal enemies, the Chinese Communist Party. Mr. Ambassador, it's great to have you back at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the Corporate Complicity Scorecard. What is its purpose, as you see it, and what does it do to advance it?
Well, thank you. Stepping back and looking at the challenge we face with the Chinese Communist Party in China today, it's very clear we are in a deep, long-term, going to be a decades-long struggle. And we have to understand how this is both similar and different than struggles we as the United States have faced in the past. I mean, obviously, the greatest analogies are to the Cold War, facing down again a totalitarian, communist dictatorship under the Soviet Union. And while there's lots of parallels that can be drawn, in many ways, we are in a very different situation. The United States was never economically integrated with the Soviet Union. Because of U.S. policy over the last, three plus decades, we have become increasingly economically integrated with China today. And while that may have been well-intentioned at the time, has clearly led to not the kind of hopeful liberalization and political liberalization that folks had hoped for that would take root in China, but instead has served to strengthen the economic and military power of the communist regime there. And even more damaging potentially than that, has begun to kind of weaken the resolve we have in the US and I think other parts of the West to confronting it because of the concerns of economic dependency. So looking at that as a kind of a baseline situation, what we think is important is to understand what exactly is the nature, to begin to understand it, what is the nature of this internet, economic integration we have with China? What is the exposure? What is the nature of the relationship between different US actors and China, and how does that fit into the picture? And importantly, we frequently hear stories and anecdotal examples of, there's a particular company that has some sort of relationship or is engaged with China, and that sounds bad, or maybe it's not so bad. And it's very hard, I think, for Americans and public policymakers to understand, well, how does that fit in as part of a larger context? So what we wanted to do is to start to provide a kind of baseline understanding for measuring and assessing how a U.S. company is engaged in economic activity in China. And we say in our report that as a premise, we're not saying that any economic relationship or doing business in China is necessarily bad. But what we want to do is we want to start and create a systematic baseline where we examine, okay, what are what we think are the most clearly problematic areas that we think, frankly, everyone would agree would be problematic and shouldn't be going on, and then do an examination, not just of one company, but of multiple companies to see, okay, how do they stack up? Are they all the same? Are they different? And why is that? So this report that we just released this month is our first attempt at doing that. We highlight eight American, mostly technology companies of Amazon, Apple, Dell, Facebook, GE, Google, Intel, and Microsoft. and do a pretty deep dive, you know, as much as we can based on what information is available through, you know, transparent reporting of the nature of their activities, and provide a kind of aggregate score where we grade them on that. So we're very proud of this first report.
It is important to note that it is a first report, because I know you will not leave unnoted the very important contribution to this problem that is being made by the financial sector as well. But just staying with what are basically, I guess, the big tech companies that you've addressed so far, slave labor would seem to be one of the attributes that is very, you know, reprehensible about all of this. But talk more broadly about the extent to which these companies are transferring technology and artificial intelligence and other capabilities that are inherently dual use, Andrew Brumberg, as you know, and likely to wind up being really detrimental to our security, not just our competitiveness as a nation.
Yeah, so we developed different components for how we were going to grade companies in terms of their activities in China. So the first is we developed a very basic, what we called an auto fail test, that kind of regardless of how you scored in other categories later, you were going to fail if they appear to operate facilities in Xinjiang. I think it's important that, you know, everyone understands the genocide happening in Western China that the United States, both under President Trump and under the President Biden, have recognized is a genocide, is very, very real. We're talking about the lives of millions of people that have been held captive in concentration camps, and that any direct involvement with that is morally reprehensible. Now, that's not just me saying it. The Congress actually just passed a very bipartisan bill that the president signed into law that makes clear any importation of any product that could have originated in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region is presumed to have been made with forced labor and needs to be barred and can't come in. This is newly passed. This the enforcement of this law has not yet gone into effect, and it's something we're going to be closely monitoring to see how that happens, because this is incredibly important. So in that context, we said, if you're operating facilities in the Xinjiang Autonomous Uyghur Autonomous Region, you're going to fail. So that was something that we set out right at the outset. Then we looked at a kind of more aggregated set of criteria that focused on the organization's operations in the country and how those what those activities around their operations looked like, and also the partnerships that they were engaged in with Chinese military surveillance or other human rights abuses and other elements of their, you know, relationships with different entities. Because of course, it's very difficult given the Chinese government's policy, particularly around civil and military fusion, which of course what and as well as its intelligence laws, national security intelligence laws, that it creates the very clear reality that even if you think you're acting with a kind of private sector element in China, they are required under law to partner with, whether it is the PLA or other intelligence apparatuses, at sharing information. So this is a very, you know, difficult area for companies to navigate, and they need to be very cautious in doing so. So that is the rubric under which we designed this scoring system. That unfortunately, the vast majority of the companies we looked at failed.
This is why you were looking at them, I think. It's no accident, comrade, as they used to say in the Soviet Union. But Andrew, just a quick question on this. These companies have been threatened by the Chinese Communist Party, as I understand it, that if they comply with U.S. law, they will be violating Chinese law, and they will lose market share at the very minimum, and perhaps even worse might befall them. Is that correct? And if so, how are they navigating these twin competing demands?
You are exactly right. We've seen cases where companies went and putting out simple statements, just kind of acknowledging that they will be complying with U.S. law, have now been, you know, kind of accused and, you know, attacked by the Chinese government or some of their other mouthpiece kind of outlets, and said that, yeah, your market share is going to be threatened. And I think there's no easy way out of this problem. I mean, companies are going to have to find a way to responsibly and appropriately reduce their exposure to the most heinous abuses happening in China, not just the what's happening with the Uyghurs and the genocide. I mean, that's legal. They have to. But also these areas of helping with surveillance. And I mean, we're talking about the development of surveillance technology in China that's going to be used by the most totalitarian regime on the planet. Their cooperation in helping the PLA, the People's Liberation Army in China, modernize its military system. This is the military that we have the greatest threat of attacking, potentially being at war with the United States. So these are relationships that have to be, I think, exposed. And then we have to make sure we do everything we can to encourage or require these companies to unwind that. And I want to just give one example where we had highlighted in our report that both Dell and GE had operations located in Xinjiang. And when our report came out, we were very pleased, initially pleased to see that Dell responded that saying, oh, this office and this facility in Xinjiang is actually in the process of being closed. Now, I think they couched that in the context of saying, well, it's being closed because we don't really need it or it's not being utilized. And you know what? Fine. I'll take it. And I think it goes to show that that's the one steps we can take by saying, look, we have to examine how these companies are behaving, expose it to public transparency, and hopefully we'll see those companies begin to change. So I think that's a great positive outcome that, in this one case, they're closing that facility. Now, again, to the point you just raised, they, of course, feel the need to couch it in a way in which it doesn't sound like they're agreeing with our premise or that they're, being insensitive, let's say, to the Chinese Communist Party's concern because they still have important other, business activities with the country. But I think that's clearly a positive example about the importance of this work and how it can be used to actually start to change how U.S. companies are engaged in China.
It is heartening. Let me turn to a further, inquiry, I guess, about the next report. Will you take on those like, BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street and Fidelity and other JP Morgan and such, titans in our financial sector who are, if anything, even more egregiously providing a degree of corporate complicity in empowering our mortal enemies, the Chinese communists, by underwriting their activities in this broad array of things they call unrestricted warfare against us, and doing so, as you know, Andrew, with our money. I mean, it's American investors' money that is flowing by some estimates the trillions of dollars for these nefarious purposes. This would seem to me to be something that warrants your urgent attention as well. Is that likely to be forthcoming?
I couldn't agree more. As you had said, this report had focused on this group of technology companies, and we recognize that in terms of the other areas of exposure, obviously exposure from retail sector, from the manufacturing sector, and as you've just focused on, financial services and investment sector are extremely troubling. And I think some of the examples you just mentioned are probably the most concerning, frankly, of almost all of these sectors in terms of the amount of money that has gone from the United States to support these entities. I'll give one example. So in responding to some of our observations and criticisms of how these tech companies have partnered, particularly in the in the technology and surveillance space, their defense has been, well, the entity we are technically partnered with, right, is actually not on the U.S. government's Commerce Department's entities list that we are prohibited from partnering with. I say, okay, to their credit, they're at least not breaking U.S. law explicitly. Okay, good start, not enough, but. But this is where the irony is, right? Which is that was their defense. Well, we're not partnering. We're not doing technology transfers with those companies. The firms you just mentioned and many others are in fact invested in the very same blacklisted or sanctioned companies in China. And I want to make sure I didn't, like, I made that clear that there are most investment firms in the United States, and frankly, in many of their large mutual fund portfolios, where, you know, a passive investor, the average American with a retirement 401k plan that's invested in a broadly diversified international fund, right? They frequently include companies in that list that are sanctioned in one way, shape, or form by the United States government, that U.S. companies are prohibited from actually selling technology or doing business with, but are still investing Americans' hard-earned dollars in. And I think that is absolutely unacceptable, unconscionable, and those leaders in those sectors need to cease doing it immediately. And if they don't, which unfortunately is what I suspect, it will likely fall to policymakers, and I think our government leaders need to force them to.
Well, and again, the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation is enormously influential with those leaders. And I pray that by focusing attention on this other universe of bad actors, that this will be addressed as it should be. Because as you say, it's not only ignominious that we are enabling and empowering and emboldening, for heaven's sakes, our mortal enemies. It's dangerous, you know? And as you said, really about both the technology folks and these financiers, to the extent that they are directly compounding the capacity of the Chinese Communist Party to attack the people of this country. And worse, in the case of the financiers, they're doing it with some of those people's own money. It is reprehensible in the extreme and must stop. So I look forward to the next edition of the Corporate Complicity Scorecard. Let me just ask you, if I may, in sort of our closing minutes with you, Ambassador Andrew Brennberg. I had an interesting conversation in yesterday's program with an individual who had previously served as the chief economic advisor to President Vladimir Putin of Russia. His name is Andrei Ilarionov. He had a very strong closing comment about the importance of the free world. And I have to say, there aren't enough of us talking about the free world, that it even exists anymore, let alone its importance. Your organization is all about preserving, protecting, and otherwise ensuring the survival of freedom and the nations that embrace and defend it, most especially ours, of course, against these various communist entities. I wanted to give you a chance just to say something about the importance of the free world as you see it, and why we have a vested interest in its survival, and what you see might be the mortal threat to it posed by not just the Chinese Communist Party, but the axis that it is now pronounced with Putin's Russia. And I think it's fair to say, whether it's been formalized or not, in practical terms, with Iran and with North Korea, and Pakistan perhaps, and others who, in our own hemisphere not least, are aligned not with the free world, but with its enemy.
Yeah, and this goes to the fundamental nature of the challenge we face today that I think is very reminiscent and similar. You know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. to the challenge we faced with the Soviet Union, in terms of the United States as the leader, as we always have been, as the leader of the free world, has both the obligation and responsibility to stand for our values and to then do everything we can to rally other countries in the free world that, you know, profess to share these values and want to maintain, you know, freedom for as much of the world as possible, to stand together in opposition. So I think both in the case of what we're dealing with China right now, the United States is, I think, at the forefront in recognizing the nature of that threat, and leading in response. Now, I wish we would be even further along that road, but I'm always optimistic we are going to continue to make progress in this fight because, you know, the truth is on our side. And that other countries will follow along with us. You know, they are behind us right now in terms of they haven't quite gotten to that point. But I tell you, when Europeans read and see the nature of the corporate complicity of their companies in China in genocide, I don't think that will stand in their countries either. But so I think it's important that the framing of this as a free world challenge is absolutely true, and we need to think of it that way as we go to build these strong alliances to deal with this threat. But specifically about the challenge of Ukraine, I think it's been very confusing for a lot of Americans, unfortunately, because a lot of Americans don't understand the history of Central Eastern Europe, Russia under communism. I mean, we see this all the time. This is one of our fundamental, you know, mission is to educate Americans about the victims of communism. You know, if you do not understand the Holodomor, you know, Stalin's imposed famine on Ukraine that resulted in the death of millions of people. You know, this is the policy set down to kill so that they would die. You will not understand the current geopolitical crisis going on with Russia and Ukraine today. I mean, that's my belief. Like, if you don't understand that history, and the continual suffering of the Ukrainian people under the Soviet Union, you can't understand the dynamic of what's going on today. And I think I find it troubling that we've heard from, you know, some people suggesting that, you know, we shouldn't care for some reason. And I'll just share my personal perspective. So I always, you know, loved Ronald Reagan's leadership and, you know, his firm moral stance, but, you know, in the face of evil, but he would always face it with strength, but not looking for a war. And I'm very sympathetic to the idea that we don't want to be involved or get involved or end up in a war with Russia. I mean, I think that would be devastating on many levels. And I know some people that have commented recently on this nature have said, well, Ukraine is not in NATO and we don't have a treaty obligation to defend. Those are true statements, but that only goes so far as to say that, well, you're just not advocating that we should get in a, you know, shooting war with Russia right now. But our ability to stand with Ukraine, to publicly advocate and stand against and stand in opposition to these threats by Russia doesn't need to include as the first step moving on a path to war. I mean, there are so many other things that we can and must do to publicly stand for freedom and stand for these people. And I think frequently sometimes in the media, we see it being confused as a kind of false equivalency that somehow being committed to the liberty of Ukraine and standing up for their freedom and, you know, calling out, you know, completely inappropriate, unwarranted Russian aggression. I think it's important to call out Russia's violations of international law and international agreements they've agreed to. These are what it means to stand for them and to prepare strong economic consequences and sanctions should Russia act more. I think it's a false equivalence to suggest that's, you know, putting the America on the footing for war. So I think it's an important issue, and it's, I think, somewhat symptomatic to see, you know, believe me, Beijing, the Chinese Communist Party is closely watching how this works. And what they're mostly watching is how the U.S. is able to rally and coordinate with our allies. Because I can tell you from my experience dealing with the Chinese in the diplomatic circles, while they pay attention to what we say, they honestly are very, you know, I'd say arrogant. And don't worry a lot about what the U.S. says or does necessarily. I think, you know, they feel they've eclipsed us or they're going to eclipse us, and that's not their concern. What keeps them up at night is what I talked about earlier, the ability of the United States to rally the free world against communism and this challenge. That they know they can't handle. So what I think they're closely watching is how does the United States, along with our partners and allies, successfully coordinate and work together to stand down this, you know, aggression by Putin. And if they see that being successful, that will have them much more worried, I think, frankly, than anything else.
That's a very important closing comment. It actually is one that I hope we might pick up on another occasion soon, because it does seem to me, I call it every weeknight here, the war for the free world. And it doesn't, as you say, require that it be a kinetic war, but we kid ourselves if we think we are not in one, not because we don't want to be, but because adversaries like the Chinese Communist Party, for that matter, I think Vladimir Putin, the Iranians, and others I've mentioned, are all about trying to take down the free world and supplant it with one to their liking that would be inimical to freedom, to say the least. I think it absolutely important that your public education mission not only carry on, but be greatly intensified. And I know you're as excited as I am about the prospect, probably more so, of this museum being a powerful new means of conveying all of that. I'm so proud of Lee Edwards, who had the vision of this decades and decades and decades ago, and is now seeing it come to fruition. I hope, if I might just say in closing, Mr. Ambassador, that Tucker Carlson will be one of your first visitors, because I think he could use a little bit of education on particularly some of that history that you've talked about in Eastern Europe. Meantime, Godspeed, my friend, and please do come back to us with updates on all of this, and especially that new report on the financial sector. We're anxiously awaiting it.
In the meantime, well, thank you so much.
Thanks for your great work and great service to our country. Godspeed. Thanks to all of you for listening to our program. Hope you'll do so again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A revered friend of mine has just survived the latest of myriad surgeries as part of many months of desperate attempts to save his life. To protect his privacy, let's call him Tim. Tim is one of the most brilliant national security practitioners of his generation. He's a distinguished veteran of combat overseas and the bureaucratic wars in Washington. Tim's experience mirrors what's been happening to the country he loves so deeply and has served so well. Like America, he's been racked by disease, debilitating hardships, and skyrocketing costs. Also like the USA, Tim is tenaciously fighting to survive the forces of darkness working to take him down. His heroic courage is an inspiration to those of us who love him and a hopeful sign that our nation will pull through too. Please join me in praying for Tim and for America. This is Frank Gaffney.